Hey, we all know how tough it can be to find the time to sit down and make progress on a book you've been trying to read. Tell me about it. I've got two kids. But what if I told you it's possible to absorb 10 nonfiction books in just an afternoon? Well, that's exactly what today's sponsor, Blinkist.com/ROF, allows you to do. Blinkist is the only app that takes popular nonfiction books, distills them down into summaries that you can read or listen to in about 15 minutes. You'll still get the most important takeaways and the crucial information from each book, but it'll be so in a concise, efficient package that you can consume in one sitting or at the gym or on your way to work or in between podcasts. Now look, I know I want to make time for reading as many books as I can, but there's only so many hours in the week. So why not go ahead and get the most valuable insights from nonfiction books that you otherwise wouldn't have had time for? They have everything from politics, history, philosophy, to economics, business, psychology, and personal development. You can try Blinkist totally free and get access to their library of thousands of condensed nonfiction books by going to Blinkist.com/ROF. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/ROF.
Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. Today on the show, Donald Trump's national emergency declaration is being challenged in court by 16 states, and House Democrats are doing everything in their power to block it. I'll bring you the details. Kyla Mandel from Think Progress will be here to tell us about the billions of dollars we're having to pay each year as a result of climate change. Author and Daily Coast writer David Nywert will tell us why the MAGA hat crowd is more like the post-Civil War red shirts than the KKK. And I'll be taking your questions from Twitter. Just send them using the hashtag AskROF. And don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show commercial-free, just become a member. That's the best way to support the show. That's ROFpodcast.com. You can also support the show on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/theringoffire. So let's get things started today with the biggest news of the week. So we got to start off today talking about, obviously, the biggest news of the past week, which is Donald Trump's national emergency declaration that he made last Friday. A lot's developed in just the last week on this issue. Right now, we currently have 16 different states that have filed a lawsuit to block this emergency order. And that obviously, I mean, that's something every one of us thought was going to happen. Donald Trump himself, in his declaration, with his little sing-song language, told us that this was going to happen. He said they're going to file the suits, it's going to be in the Ninth Circuit, and then it's going to get appealed. I apologize for my horrid impression there, but that's how he said it. That's what he said, and that's correct, actually. It is filed in the Ninth Circuit. California is the leading state in this lawsuit, so that's what's happening right now. On Friday, Democrats introduced their resolution in the House of Representatives to block this emergency declaration. It has essentially turned everybody on social media into constitutional scholars. You got half the people saying this is constitutional, half saying it's not constitutional. So, you know, for just a second, let's take a very just clear-cut view of what the law actually says. For starters, can Donald Trump declare a national emergency? Yes, that is unequivocal. He can do that. And then that's about the extent to which those powers go. That's it. He can declare the national emergency. Now, once you do that, any president, and Republicans love to say, well, Obama did it. Yeah, Obama did it when there was actual national emergencies. Trump himself admitted in his declaration speech that I didn't have to do this. I just did it because I wanted this wall done faster. Which essentially, I mean, that statement alone sets up the courts to be able to say, no, this does not qualify as a national emergency. The only problem is that the law itself, you know, the part of the Constitution or, you know, our laws that say he can do this, it doesn't define what a national emergency actually is. Vagueness is always going to benefit the party that's doing it. You know, vagueness is going to benefit the defendant, which in this case would be Trump. And because the law does not say what could be a national emergency, he could easily, you know, say, yeah, maybe it's not, maybe it is, but the law doesn't say it actually has to be one. So there's a little bit of ambiguity there. But the problem for Trump is not necessarily the legality of his declaration itself, because the declaration is only, you know, the first piece of the puzzle here. What he really needs to worry about is whether or not he can actually get the funding through the methods that he thinks he's going to get the funding from. Because when you declare a national emergency, there are several different routes that you can go. First and foremost, you can declare a national emergency. You can submit it to Congress for funding approval, and Congress can vote yes or no. Trump's obviously not going to do that because the Democrats in Congress are not stupid enough to give him that money. Then the other route is to go through the Pentagon. And that's obviously where he's headed with this. He wants to take money from the military in order to pay for this border wall. A lot of the funds actually are coming out of a fund that was going to be used to create new housing for our soldiers. He's taking new houses away from our soldiers or troops, the people that Republicans tell us they love. They're the party of the troops, right? Well, now you can't have new housing. You can't have updated housing. You can't have nice things because I'm taking your money away to build a wall that nobody wants. And that's not the end of it, though. You know, he's also taking money out of disaster relief funds for Puerto Rico, fire funds for California, school funds that were actually directed through the Pentagon to build new schools. That's coming out of it, allegedly. But because here's the thing, when a national emergency is declared and you take the money from the military then become the ones who have to do the project. So that's a big part of the story that a lot of people have missed, but it's something that is part of that avenue of getting the money. If it's a national emergency, and if you take it from the military has to carry out the order, which means if Trump takes the money from the military, then it's going to be our soldiers, our troops down there on the border actually physically building the wall. I don't think anyone explained that to him. And I don't think that's going to go over very well with our soldiers. I just don't. You know, call me crazy, but I don't think these people are going to think, you know what, this is exactly what I signed up for. Yeah, you know, I wanted to keep America safe, so I'm here laying cement and stacking steel slats. Not going to go over very well. The other thing about all of this that's actually been driving me kind of crazy is the fact that people kind of stopped caring as the week started. You know, Monday, this is a big story. And then you've got Jussie Smollett. You've got stories about the rise in hate crimes that kind of countered the Smollett thing. You've got the Lieutenant Coast Guard found with a cache of weapons and an enemies list. He was going to go kill journalists and politicians. You had Mueller. You had Cohen. You had the Saudi Arabia stories, which I'm going to hit on a little bit more coming up here. But a lot of news kind of buried the whole national emergency thing. Democrats in Congress were still working on it, worked on their resolution, got it out there on Friday. But the media had already moved on, which is important because had the Democrats not been the party in control of the House of Representatives, this story already would have been over. You know, these lawsuits that these 16 states have filed, that would have been an afterthought. You know, that would have been a footnote. That would have been something, a battle happening in our court system that people would not be paying attention to. So, you know, thank goodness we had an opposition party running the House of Representatives. Otherwise, this whole story, everybody would have forgotten it It would have been a thing that just happened, and Trump would have gotten away with it. Listen, we need to take a quick break. We're going to be right back with more Ring of Fire. And don't forget, subscribe to our YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Fresh videos 7 days a week. I'm Farron Cousins, in for Sam Cedar. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey, one of today's sponsors, BetterHelp.com/ROF. BetterHelp is an online service that gives you access to your own experienced, fully licensed therapist. You can do so by way of phone, video, or text. When you see a therapist in person in their office, it about takes 3 weeks on average before you're actually able to get your first appointment. But with BetterHelp, you're matched with a therapist who fits your needs within just 24 hours. And you get the same professional service. And the best part, BetterHelp is less expensive than seeing a therapist in person. Plus, you'll have totally unlimited access to the therapist. You can talk to them whenever you want, on your phone or on your computer. And because BetterHelp believes in what they do, they have a full money-back guarantee. If, for whatever reason, you're not happy with the service, you'll get a full refund, no questions asked. All of their therapists go through an extensive vetting process and are required to have at least 3 years of experience before joining BetterHelp. So you know you're getting someone who is fully qualified to help you. But if you don't think your therapist is a good fit, BetterHelp lets you switch to someone new at any time. Get started right now by going to BetterHelp.com/ROF.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. You can catch me on our Ring of Fire YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. And make sure you're following the show on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. We're going to jump back into the news now. There's a lot of things that happened this week. We were just talking about Donald Trump's national emergency, which is not actually a national emergency, but a couple other seeming emergencies emerged this week. Most notably, the fact that this massive story came out, thanks to whistleblowers and Elijah Cummings, his filing from the House Oversight Committee, that revealed that the Trump administration, almost since day one, have been trying to sell nuclear secrets and technology to Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration has been trying to sell nuclear technology to Saudi Arabia, one of the biggest aggressors in the entire Middle East. Here's that story. Michael Flynn, who was, of course, Donald Trump's very first national security advisor, pitched the administration on this idea. He wanted to sell this nuclear technology over to Saudi Arabia. And originally, whistleblowers got concerned because one of the firms that was going to benefit from this was a firm that Flynn had served as an advisor for. So they thought, hey, you know what? This isn't on the level. Flynn wants to sell secrets that's going to benefit a company that he has been, at least in the past, financially connected to. Somebody needs to look into this. So whistleblowers initially said, this guy's got a huge conflict of interest here. Flynn leaves. And we all know what's going on with Flynn now. But the deal didn't stop. You know, this idea, this plan, it still kept kicking around in their heads. And as recently as last week, there was a confirmed meeting inside the Oval Office. Rick Perry was there that talked about Rick Perry, as well as representatives from the National Security Council, the State Department, and about a dozen nuclear industry CEOs were there. And they were talking about, how do we get this tech to Saudi Arabia? Here's what they're saying. They say, listen, this tech we're going to give them, these secrets, it's only because Saudi Arabia wants to build nuclear reactors. They want nuclear power plants. You know, they're switching over, switching their tech. They want to be a slightly cleaner energy source. So they want this tech because they want nuclear power plants. And I'm going to explain in just a moment why that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. But then they made another argument that says, and listen, if we don't do this, what they're going to do is Saudi Arabia is going to go to Russia or China, and then those countries will sell them the technology needed or the secrets needed. And then they're going to be best friends with Saudi Arabia, and we're going to, you know, hurt our relationship with them if we're not the ones to do it. You know, we always have to be the super BFF to Saudi Arabia, and we can't have another, you know, tertiary friend come in and sell them these secrets. Also, a completely bogus and stupid argument, but it is the argument that the administration is making. Now, the national security advisors, they're absolutely livid. They think this idea, as most of us do, is absolutely horrendous and stupid. They do not want this to happen because, like me, they understand what's really happening here. And I think most of us understand what's really happening here. Saudi Arabia does not care about nuclear power plants. That whole argument is absolutely crazy. This is one of the most fossil fuel rich countries on the planet. And suddenly they say, you know what? Maybe this climate change thing is a big deal. Maybe we need to at least go halfway and go to nuclear power for our country that is flooded with fossil fuels. No, it takes a special kind of stupid to believe something like that. Saudi Arabia has no interest whatsoever in nuclear power. Saudi Arabia wants to be a nuclear power, and they want our help. They want our help to do it, and this administration is clearly dumb enough to do it. But a nuclear Saudi Arabia, unfortunately, thanks to Trump, is not the only thing we have to worry about. A week or so ago, Trump pulls the United States out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF treaty that was signed, that essentially helped to end the Cold War, signed by Ronald Reagan. And it essentially told us that neither the U.S. nor Russia was going to make these long or intermediate range missiles, nuclear missiles, that could hit, you know, the other country. We're going to stop that. We're not going to bomb you from the comfort of our own home. Trump pulls the United States out of this under the false advice from the State Department that said Russia's been violating it anyway. We don't need to be a part of it. This is stupid. Same State Department, mind you, that said Iraq had aluminum tubes and yellow cake and was building weapons of mass destruction. And we all know how that turned out. So on the poor advice from the State Department, Trump pulls us out of the INF. Then this week, on Wednesday, Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, says, okay, if you put nuclear weapons closer to us here in Russia, then we are going to do the same thing to you. So if you move nuclear weapons closer to our border, we're going to move some closer to your border, and we're going to be ready to deploy. And suddenly, we're right back in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're right back at the heart of the Cold War because Donald Trump was too stupid to understand the importance of this treaty. And if they believed, which they have not yet been able to provide solid, credible evidence that Russia was violating it anyway, if they believed that they were, there were other avenues to take instead of ripping up a treaty that helped end a nuclear standoff that lasted for decades. But that's how bad Trump is. That's what happens when you elect a reality show star instead of a statesman. That's what happens when you put an idiot in the White House instead of somebody who is capable of critical thought. So, yes, we are right back in the Cold War. And what's funny to me about this is you had a lot of people, mostly from, I don't want to call them the fringe left, but they are, you know, who accused progressives and liberals and Democrats of trying to start a new Cold War by saying that Russia interfered in our 2016 election. And now, in a plot twist that nobody saw coming, it was Trump himself who quite literally started the new Cold War. Because this isn't about election interference. This isn't about hacking. This isn't about spending a couple $100,000 on Facebook ads. We're now back to talking about nuclear weapons and Russia's threat or promise to put them closer to our borders if we look like we're going to put them closer to theirs. And the only people who benefit from this, Putin's not benefiting from it, Trump's not benefiting from it. The only people who are benefiting from this withdrawal from the INF are military defense contractors. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to have Kyla Mandel from Think Progress here to tell us why we're already paying the costs for extreme climate change here in the United States. That's coming up, so stay with us right here on Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire Radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar today. You know, one of the biggest criticisms that we hear from the crowd that's actually preventing us from even addressing climate change is, how are we going to pay for it? Well, those critics need to understand that as a country, we're already paying for the cost of climate change to the tune of almost $100 billion just last year alone. Joining me now to talk about these costs is Kyla Mandel, associate editor at Think Progress. So, Kyla, a couple weeks ago, we had the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, released a new report showing us just how much we're already spending as a country on these climate disasters that only seem to be increasing. Tell us what this report gave us in terms of information about the financials here.
Sure, yeah. So last year in 2018, NOAA found that there were 14 different weather and climate disasters, and each of them cost more than $1 billion. But then within that, there were really only three big events that stood out, and each of them cost about $24 to $25 billion alone. So that was Hurricane Michael and Hurricane Florence, which hit in the fall and quite late into the hurricane season, as well as the wildfire out in California. So to have the bulk of all of those 14 events really be comprised of just three really big ones. And so together, those three cost about $73 billion, and the total for all 14 was about $91 billion. And, you know, that's just money. You've also got all of these events claimed the lives of about 247 people. So, you know, there's heavy costs.
Yeah, and what's remarkable too about these the three big ones, you know, the 25 mm-hmm. billion, 24 billion, 24 billion, you know, fires, Florence, Michael, the three of those are all disasters that essentially are exacerbated by climate change. You know, the stronger hurricanes, you know, with both Michael and Florence, which Michael, you know, hit right down the road from me. We were lucky enough to be spared most of the damage, but, you know, 30, 45 minutes down the road from us here, it's absolute chaos and still is. I drove through that part of Florida just a few weeks ago. You know, the trees are still sideways. They've been completely uprooted as if they were just pulled directly out of the ground. I mean, it's absolutely crazy to see this happen. And I'm somebody, I've been through, you know, countless hurricanes in my life, and I've never seen that extent up close and personal other than on TV. And so here we have these disasters. The fires in California, obviously one of the bigger ones, those raged on for weeks. We actually had media coverage of that. And so the fire season in California, as you've pointed out here, it used to be, you know, a couple months out of the year, but now essentially because of the problems of climate change, because of the droughts, this fire season has essentially become a year-round thing for the state of California, hasn't it?
Right, right. I remember last year covering all of this, And early in the summer, you know, there are already devastating wildfires, and not just in California, but I mean, throughout the summer, then you saw in Greece, for example, and I believe there are also some up in Sweden, you know, all over the place. And they just continued with campfire in California well into November. And I mean, you know, that's a large chunk of the year. And then now authorities are gearing up to prepare for the next season.
And what we see here, too, is that it doesn't always just have to be a big event. It doesn't have to be the thing that grabs the headlines. It doesn't have to be, you know, the massive superstorm or, you know, miles and miles of fire. You know, the other remaining, the 91 billion total, 73 from three events, the remainder came from relatively small weather phenomenon here in the United States. You know, just you point out the fact that we had a 24-hour period of rain in Hawaii that dumped almost 50 inches of rain in 24 hours. You know, these are all climate problems. These are anomalies that are starting to become a lot more common, and instead of just being these freak storms that would pop up every 10 or 20 years, right?
Right, exactly. And I think that we've seen this in a few of the reports that came out this year from the IPCC and from the National Climate Assessment that talk about how, you know, climate change is going to make things more extreme. So whether that is places becoming a lot wetter or places becoming a lot drier, and, you know, those just get more exaggerated. And I mean, out here in DC as well, I mean, it was a record rainfall year in 2018. We just, you know, we're dumped with rain. So definitely it's not necessarily always these big events, like you're saying. It can definitely be just sort of a constant, just wetter, drier.
And to me, the most interesting part of this, especially right now with all the talk of the Green New Deal, is the big question always comes up: how are you going to pay for this? How are you going to pay for this? Well, the truth is, we're already paying for it. That's what this is. That's what this $90 billion price tag is. You know, we're talking about over the last since 1980. You point this out here on Think Progress. Since 1980, $1.6 trillion. So 30 year, more than $1 trillion price tag for extreme weather events. So when people say, how can we pay for, you know, the Green New Deal? How can we pay for any kind of climate action? The answer is, in the long run, it's going to be cheaper than having to just patch things up as we go, you know, paying $25 billion for a hurricane here or $24 billion for a wildfire there. These costs add up quickly, and we're already paying those each and every year.
Right, exactly. I think that, you know, a lot of this has always been sort of reactionary. You know, an event happens, then you come in and you repair and rebuild and, you know, you're responding to the event, and that's where all those costs are coming in. But then it's a lot harder to start thinking forward and how can we prevent those future costs by spending some money now to, you know, maybe improve our infrastructure or do what needs to happen in terms of where do we build new homes or where do we build new roads and all of those questions, and thinking about it a little bit more smarter and more comprehensively. Because like you say, so over the past 30 years, it cost us $1.6 trillion just for natural disasters. And those are just, you know, becoming more damaging and are increasing as the world is warming. So another part of the data within NOAA that was released showed that, so over the past 30 years, the average number of these events each year was about six separate billion-dollar events. Whereas if you just look at the past 5 years, that number has more than about doubled. And that's coincided with the warmest years on record. So 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018 are all the four warmest years on record. So it's just going to keep, you know, being more devastating. And so it's about how do we think proactively and smartly so that, you know, the money is spent properly and you don't have these huge costs down the road.
Right. I mean, it'll save us a lot of money in the long run if we start addressing the problem now rather than just, oh, a thing happened here. Now we've got to go patch this up. Now we've spent tens of billions of dollars and we still haven't addressed the actual cause of this. So at this point, you know, I don't want to say we're throwing money away because we do have to fix these areas that get destroyed. But at the same time, we're also using money that could have been used 20 years ago to address the problem itself. And instead, we're having to use that to create this patchwork of repair, replace, but then there's nothing left to fix the problem. Look, we need to take a quick break, but we're going to pick up with more of this when we come back.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop, use the coupon code MAJORITY, and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins in for Sam Cedar today. Right now, I'm talking with Kyla Mandel, the associate editor for Think Progress's climate team. And we're talking about the rising costs of climate change related disasters right here in the United States. So, Kyla, before the break, we were talking about all of the money that we've been spending as a country over the last 30 years, $1.6 trillion on climate disasters, according to recent data from NOAA. You mentioned in one of your pieces on Think Progress a couple weeks ago, there was a committee hearing. The House Committee on Energy and Commerce held a climate hearing. You know, that's something that probably couldn't have happened, you know, in the previous 2 years. But now we do have Democrats in charge. Democrats are running things. So did anything come of this climate hearing?
Right. Yeah, I think that for the first time in, I mean, maybe a decade, climate change seems to really be on the political agenda. It seems to be a top priority that a lot of politicians are talking about. And, you know, there's a lot of momentum behind it. A lot of people are demanding action and that politicians take this seriously. So it wasn't just this one House hearing. I think on that day, there was maybe three different hearings focused on climate change happening all at the same time, which, I mean, I don't remember the last time that's happened. So in this one that I was watching, you know, they talked about the costs of climate change and how we're seeing it happen now. I think all these natural disasters that people are living through really resonate with them. And, you know, whether it's a politician or you know, a local resident, people are realizing that it's happening. It's here. It's costing us a lot, both money and, you know, emotional tolls and lives and all of that. And so, you know, what you heard politicians talking about was that the costs are becoming more obvious and the need to act is becoming clearer.
And what's interesting, too, is, you know, when we talk about these climate disasters, we do typically talk about things that are essentially heat related. You know, the warmer the water, the stronger the hurricanes, you know, the warmer the air, the drier the land, the bigger the wildfire. But, you know, just in the last couple of weeks, we're also seeing climate change in the form of these massive winter storms that have gripped the Midwest and the Northeast, you know, plummeting the temperatures down to lower than what it was into Antarctica. And yet we have a president here who says, man, we could use some of that good old fashioned global warming. Completely missing the point that even a snowstorm, a blizzard, a monster ice storm, that is also climate change. And I know the science behind that is a little more complex than what Trump is probably able to grasp or what the media is able to tell in a 5-minute segment. But those are climate storms, too. I mean, this is climate change making those worse.
No, of course. There was actually, in response to one of the Trump tweets, I think he's sent multiple of those. But in response to one of them, NOAA actually tweeted out a fun cartoon which tried to sort of explain why global warming might mean bigger winter storms, which can be quite counterintuitive. But effectively, the cartoon shows a little kettle over the ocean and is creating moisture. So as, you know, as the water warms, it becomes more moist and that goes into the atmosphere and, you know, it feeds into the clouds and you know, it's just more moisture to dump. And so, you know, during the winter, that can come out as snow.
and it was, look, it was a great illustration. And it did, I mean, that helped explain it, I think, to a lot of people. And it is nice to see NOAA and you know, any other government organization out there coming out and trying to correct the misinformation that's unfortunately at this point coming out of the actual White House itself. So great job for them for explaining this to people. And you had mentioned people seem to be understanding a little bit more now. They get it. They do see it on the news. It's not frequently mentioned with climate change, unfortunately, but we are starting to see that phrase, climate change, global warming, whatever it is, that is starting to trickle into some of these news reports, and that is helping. And that's been something that has been sorely missing from any coverage of these disasters for well over a decade at this point.
Right, right. I think that slowly mainstream media is getting better at sort of helping connect those dots for readers. And, you know, it can be as simple as just adding a paragraph into an article, or, you know, if you're just speaking on TV, just saying a sentence about how, if it's a hurricane, for example, you know, ocean temperatures are warming up, which means that you are going to get stronger storms, and that's because of climate change. Or with the wildfires, you know, record droughts are made more extreme because of climate change. And I think that it can be tricky because it's very difficult for scientists to connect any one single event to climate change. And so, you know, you might not be able to say necessarily this specific storm is only because of climate change. I mean, definitely there are other factors that sort of all come together, but, you know, things getting more extreme is definitely because of climate change and all of these patterns that we're seeing collectively taken all together. Climate change is a big driver behind that.
Absolutely. And you know, we've only got a few minutes left here, so I want to kind of move on. You had another really great article that came out this week talking about, you know, the financial impacts that we're already paying again for climate change. And this one's a little bit different. This article has to do with these the nuisance flooding that we're starting to see in some coastal communities, specifically Annapolis, Maryland, was a great example you used in this piece. Tell us what this nuisance flooding is that we're starting to see.
Right. So this is flooding that can happen, you know, regardless of whether there's a storm or even just rain. It can happen on sunny days, which, you know, it's often called sunny day flooding. So basically, if there's a high tide and the water rises above what your infrastructure is built to deal with, it will just flood the roads and, you know, it'll disrupt traffic. It'll disrupt people being able to walk places because they'll suddenly have to walk through, you know, a few inches of water. And then when the high tide goes out, the water just goes out again. And so it can be very brief. And it's becoming more frequent, especially like Annapolis, Maryland is a very good example because there it's just become more frequent and people are almost getting so used to it now that they're developing new ways to drive around the city when flooding happens. They're like, oh, okay, we'll take this other route. I have a colleague actually who lives there and has been telling me about it. You know, he has to go pick up his daughter from school and takes a totally different route now. So it's just this new regular flooding that happens very briefly and frequently, and it definitely impacts local businesses, which are located right along the water.
Right. And you see, you point this out in your report here. You know, these high tide floods can reduce tourist visits by 37%. And for each, you know, percent loss in visits, that's about a 0.61% decline in revenue. So here we actually have businesses, you know, they're not in the business of polluting. They're not in the business of insurance, you know. They're just regular businesses. You know, maybe it's a little shop down the street. Maybe it's an ice cream parlor, whatever it is. They're losing money now because of these extreme tides that we have coming in. You know, the city of Miami down in South Florida has been experiencing this for several years straight. And they call it, it's the king tides. But they're encroaching more and more. They're going down the streets, you know, 6, 7, 8 inches of water just twice a day, and people have to deal with it. So not only is it a nuisance, not only is it, you know, businesses lose a lot of foot traffic and driving traffic because of the water, but this is also causing a ton of damage to the infrastructure itself. you know, roads and businesses and buildings, they are not made to have a couple inches of seawater running over them for a few hours every day. That's going to cause a lot of financial damage that we're going to have to pick up the tab for.
Definitely. I think what this study looked at specifically was when these little flooding events happen, you know, you have fewer visitors to the stores, especially in areas that rely on tourist traffic and tourist revenue. And so what they found is that in 2017, just 1 year, 8 businesses they looked at. So they didn't even look at all the businesses, just 8 businesses lost between $86,000 and $172,000 in revenue because there were, you know, reduced tourist visits and reduced people coming to the stores. And so, you know, it has a direct impact on their revenue and able to generate business. And so now they have to start thinking of ways to adapt to this. You know, are you going to start sending out newsletters to clients saying, oh, today's flooding, tomorrow will be better? Or do you build different entrances that are maybe, I don't know, if you're up a hill on the higher side of the ground, you know, and starting to think creatively about how you can adapt to this flooding so that people can still come and visit your business.
And it's unfortunate because, again, these are problems we could have started addressing years ago. Instead, we waited till they got so bad. But on the bright side, people are paying attention and they want action. Kyla Mandel, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Kyla Mandel is an associate editor for Think Progress's climate team. After the break, we're going to be taking a look at the growing field of candidates that Democrats are going to have to choose from in 2020 and how really any of these candidates stack up against Donald Trump. That's ahead, so stay with us right here on Ring of Fire Radio.